Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Male Fertility Podcast. We are absolutely honoured to be joined by Luke this week. Luke, hello.
Hi, both. How are you?
We're good, mate. We're all the much better for having you here. You're a very valued member of our community. You've been to the in-person meets, the online meets, and have even been one of our panel members for one of our men's panels. So we are really grateful for everything you do for the community and now sharing your story to help others who are going to massively benefit from that and know that they're not alone. Thank you.
Thanks for the kind words. But yeah, I think it's been a fantastic kind of community, a fantastic group of like-minded people to, I guess, learn from, but also kind of share and vent and get through it together. So it's definitely been a lifeline for me. I think my wife said a few months ago that she didn't know quite where I'd be without it. Thanks to you guys for setting it up as well.
That's great. Yeah. And that's what it's all about, is guys sharing that lived experience, whether it's really deep, meaningful stuff or talking about some pretty funny wank room stories. There was a very quite big wormhole of that recently.
It's a pleasure to have you on. And I was just sitting here thinking, obviously, you're so active in the community. You've been on a panel and you've been on the pod. Like, you've got all the badges.
Full house.
Full Nexus house.
Couple of in-person sessions.
Oh, yeah, there you go. I missed those ones. Yeah. And on the online ones. Yeah. It's filling up.
Definitely making the most of it. Yeah. Tapping into all the stuff that's going.
Ah, that's what it's there for, man. Tell us where it all started.
I guess to go back into not quite ancient history, but my now wife and I have been together coming up 9 years, although it's only been a couple of years since we actually got married. And I guess we moved in together 2019, something like that, bought a house together 2020. And like, being boring and sensible, I was like, we're buying a house and renovating a house. I want to start thinking about having kids. So we only probably started thinking about having kids in 2020, 2021. When we had the house a bit more sorted. And I guess everyone, we just thought it would generally naturally happen. And this was in and amongst COVID. So when it didn't as naturally happen in the whatever it is, 6 months they recommend, it probably wasn't as easy to get a doctor's appointment, wasn't easy to get a referral. And then it probably took us until early 2023 to identify that we needed to go down a sort of assisted conception, IVF, ICSI, and all the rest of it route. And obviously, we'll delve into the details of that, I'm sure, as we go on. But two unsuccessful rounds later, I guess during that time, it was actually at the clinic that we use, came across a leaflet about a podcast. And obviously, off the back of the podcast, got involved with the Nexus community. And I guess I found that, you know, both information in the podcast, but also the people in that group, just to be so helpful, that I thought it was probably time that I give back a little bit, as well as just receiving that. I guess that's the sort of potted history of 8 years of my relationship IVF journey.
I remember you were one of the first people that came up in the group, or you said to me, I've got the leaflet from a clinic. And that really put a big smile on my face, because as I'm sure you're aware, me and Sean spend a lot of time doing these recordings and things like that. And it's just amazing to hear that guys are getting it. No, that's amazing.
Again, we'll probably come to it in a sec, but we're just about to have a third round and we were up there for the usual scans and everything within the past couple of weeks. And they've got leaflets for both the podcast and Nexus as well on their, I think it's their like patient voice board, where they've got kind of information about like in-person and teams support groups, but also then information. I think you're the only sort of third party kind of provider that they've got information about. Other than that, it's just all their own counselling services and everything else.
That's good to know. Yeah, that's what we're there for. And just to pick up the pieces where perhaps the clinics can't, that peer support. And like we mentioned at the outset, that it's just guys just talking and sharing and just knowing that there are other people out there who get it. So your journey is such a common story, that thing of just believing you're taking all the right steps that society dictates, that you go along and then you believe it's going to be like turning on a tap almost, just starting that family. Do you remember that the first time you received that news and how that felt?
I'll be honest, not as much as I probably should do. And perhaps actually because the whole thing has been a bit up and down, that I maybe tried to not quite blank out as such, but for the first maybe year or 18 months, I guess, like any guy, or maybe just because that's the way the system is, there's a lot of focus on the woman. So the first 18 months, probably, there was no, almost no focus, almost no support given to me as the guy. When I found out that they had identified a kind of male factor, would have been Christmas 2014, so a year and a bit ago. And that probably hit me pretty hard. And I think it probably took me several months to properly come to terms with that. Like, I think particularly given, I guess, the lack of focus and the lack of attention that I'd had over the previous 18 months, it was a bit like, and now you freaking tell me that there's things that you could have, there's things wrong on my side that you could have looked at much sooner rather than just totally ignoring me and just treating me as an accessory to the kind of process. So I guess to rewind a little bit, sometime during the first sort of investigations and the first round, probably mid-2023, they did do a full scan of my testicle, which is obviously quite intrusive. And then I heard nothing about for 18 months. And it was only after we'd had 3 failed implants that I raised, oh, you know, that scan of my bollocks you did a year and a half ago, did that show anything? And they revisited it and said, oh yeah, there's a varicocele. We should probably do something about that. To be fair to them, once they'd identified that, they quite quickly did manage to get me to the front of the queue, had an embolization, blah, 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 blah. But I think the fact that they firstly had done the scan, secondly hadn't followed up, and it was only when I asked that they then turned around and realized that there's something there that they should have looked at. And I think, yeah, looking back on it, that first 18 months, almost all the focus was on Helen, my wife. And I was, yeah, as I said, just considered a bit of a kind of bit part. I think there were some appointments that I went to where on the form it was like Helen and partner. And it continues to bug me to this day that it's the building that the appointments are in is the women's health unit. And just every, I guess, because I've had that, I had that initial 18 month period where I just didn't get much in the way of sort of attention. Every time I walk in the door, it bugs me that the name of the building is women's health. We had something this time around as well, and it was completely well-meaning. I had to go in because some of the millions of HFEA forms you have to complete, I hadn't signed or they hadn't checked or something or other. And they, despite the fact that they've got my details, they've got my phone number, they contacted my wife to say, could I go in to sign some forms? You need me to do something. I'm 50% of the problem here. How about you just give me a call or just send me an email kind of thing? Yeah, I guess that's a long way round of saying, particularly because I felt I'd been completely ignored for 18 months, when they did recognize there was something that needed to be dealt with on my side, or a lot that needed to be dealt with on my side, I felt that really, yeah, it hit me pretty hard. And I felt I'd been kind of let down by the system just because they'd ignored me for so long, basically.
Yeah, it is a long time. And that's pretty much the same timeline for yourself as well, isn't it, Kieran? 18 months where you weren't looked at.
I found it, as you did, Luke, incredibly frustrating. It's a big shock to suddenly get that news, especially when you've been in that kind of hamster wheel for a while. And they go, oh, suddenly it might actually be you. Did they ever give you a reason why they hadn't followed up with the information from the scan? Because that would have really rattled me.
As I said, I had to ask and I raised it. And the person I raised it with, I don't think was even aware that the scan had been done. What now, somebody else in the team might have done, but that was with somebody relatively senior that you would have hoped would have been aware of that. And Helen and I have talked about it a lot in terms of how angry I would sort of, it's okay to be about that. And I think that there's sort of an assumption, I've maybe made peace with the fact that there's maybe an assumption that kind of, because they suggested we go down an ICSI route, that actually they can get over any male factor problem by just selecting under a microscope the sperm that are kind of suitable, I guess when we get a little bit further into our kind of journey, I know you guys hate the term, I actually don't mind it very much, by the way, but
it's endearing, but we've made our peace of it now. It's just funny.
Yeah, once we get a bit further down the line into the journey, that actually the selecting the sperm by eye under a microscope ain't going to cut it, given the insights and the stuff I've had since then. Yeah, so I guess to pick the story up, in that first 18 months, we had a good egg collection, reasonable transition from that to fertilization and embryo development. Although in hindsight, some of that developed quite slowly, which we've since found out is a kind of a signal that male factor might be an issue. Again, a sort of another missed sign in my world that, you know, that they probably missed. So yeah, we had something like 6 MVOs. We had a double implant, first of all. We then had a third transfer that was a negative test. And then I think we were, that then was us in terms of the kind of MVOs that were still thought to be viable. So that was the kind of round one, 4 transfers. And then would have probably been about a year and a bit later. We then had a second round where fertilization rate was actually better to conversion to MVO. And that was after I'd had the most advice, the most support I'd ever had from the clinic around, I guess, some advice on after the varicocele embolization. They then recommended wearing looser clothes, or all of the sort of normal things, looser clothes, not doing so long in the way of bike rides, which again, we'll probably come back to, all the sort of usual recommendations. The next round actually looked a bit better. It was better conversion, if you like, from eggs to embryos. And the first transfer didn't go anywhere. And by then we'd found out about PGTA testing. So to look at how viable the embryos were. And I think we had something like 4 embryos that in theory were good to go for testing. 2 of them didn't thaw for whatever reason. And 2 of them were then, I can never get to that around, aneuploid, I think, the ones that aren't viable. So we went from a bit of a high of we've actually had really good conversion, and it looks like maybe some of the male factor stuff has been addressed by some of the sort of lifestyle changes early. Yeah, this would have been early 2025 now, so a year and a bit ago, to then a big low of actually of the 5 or 6 embryos reduced, we've now got nothing.
Wow.
At that point, said to Helen, I don't know, maybe I'm a bit overly rational and calculating about this. I said to Helen, there's no point in just putting more emotion, money, time into just trying the same thing again and hoping for a different result kind of thing. What's the definition of insanity, whatever it is? Let's stop. And given that I've had so little focus and attention, let's try and explore what's wrong on my side. And again, probably offered a name and some stuff I'd got from the podcast. I should probably credit you guys again there. Was aware that Jonathan Ramsey is the sort of main man in this kind of space. We're based in South London, so he has some clinics in Central London. So managed to get a slot. This would have been last summer now, August 25. With him, I actually managed to get a cancellation slot. I don't know if someone was on holiday or something like that. So normally there's whatever it is, a 10, 12 week waiting list. Managed to get seen a bit sooner, which was, you know, felt like one of the first wins in terms of me getting any sort of attention. Jonathan Ramsey at that point did his usual kind of sperm analysis. I think it was at that first appointment. So I had two or three appointments with him back end of last, or sort of autumn last year. And he identified, I guess, 2 main things. One was double strand DNA breakage, which, as I mentioned before, given double strand, it's almost impossible that the manual selection of sperm under a microscope in the lab is going to get over that, because you've got a whole load of things that are just so much, my understanding of biology is just so much smaller than you can see under a microscope. And he also identified slightly low testosterone levels, gave me some supplements to try and naturally boost that. And then I guess the sort of more of the usual lifestyle, the same sorts of usual lifestyle changes. And I think I probably found it much easier to adapt and put those into practice than I had 6 months earlier. And I think thinking about it now, there's probably 2 things behind that. One is I just had 6 months to process it. Like I said, it hit me pretty hard December 2024. So perhaps by August 25, I processed it a bit more and was a bit more ready to accept what I might need to make some of these changes. And then secondly, I think, frankly, just talking to somebody who actually listened and seemed to understand what they were talking about and weren't going to ignore me and everything else like that. So I think from August 25 onwards, so what's that, 6 or 7 months, yeah, I've been on the supplements. I think the thing I found hardest in that period has been, so I do a lot of cycling normally, and Jonathan Ramsey suggested to try and keep that to a maximum 4 hours a week. I'd normally do 10 or 12. And yeah, the not cycling thing, both in terms of the sort of physical exercise, the sort of mental health benefits, that's where a lot of my friends are. So you don't go for a bike ride, you don't see your friends at a cafe or in the pub kind of thing. It was affected where we go on holiday, like trying to avoid places that have Zika, all of that sort of stuff. We're probably starting to think about moving out of London. It feels like we've got that on hold to be here. It feels pretty all-encompassing. And right down to the recommendation about how frequently you should be having sex. So it just feels there's a whole spectrum from like really practical things through friends, through very personal things that sort of take over a little bit. But yeah, I think the frequency of sex thing and the cycling thing, they're two very different things, but they've probably been the things I've found the toughest. And then I guess just to get to the end of the story, and then we can maybe go back and dig into some bits that you guys think might be more interesting. We are literally weeks away. We've got a cupboard full of, probably should take out a second mortgage for the cupboard full of medication that we've got for Helen in the corner of the room here. So we're probably 2 or 3 weeks away from the sort of next round, which we think is probably going to be our last one. We have been recommended to use Zymot as a sort of add-on, which is thought to select out the sperm that have double-strand DNA breakage, double-strand DNA damage. And I guess just for kind of context and picking up on the point I made before about like why selecting sperm under a microscope wouldn't necessarily be, would address that. I think that the sort of trial run of Zymot we did, it was something like 10 or 12 individual sperm got through the Zymot test process. So of the however many hundreds of thousands or millions or whatever, it's literally, you could count them on almost two hands kind of thing. So yeah, we're planning on using Zymot as a kind of free add-on, and then probably going to PGTA test again to make sure that we only put back in embryos that are viable. And then, yeah, so I guess in a month's time, we'll probably know whether we're zero or something above zero in terms of viable embryos to put back in. Yeah, I guess we're right at the pointy end of the process, I guess. I've been on a bit of a monologue for a while, so I'll pause there.
We really appreciate you being so open with us and with everyone who's listening. There's so much to unpack there. And you've mentioned a couple of times some lifestyle changes that were advised to you, firstly, pre-Jonathan Ramsay and then from the big dog himself, as he has been referred to before. So just for anyone who might be picking this up, who is early in their journey and perhaps hasn't gone down those wormholes or hasn't had that advice, because as you've mentioned, it was a long time before you got any. So what were those kind of top level bits of lifestyle changes and advice that you were given?
Yeah, the easier bits for me was completely stopping or very heavily moderating how much alcohol you drink. I don't drink that much anyway, but I basically not drunk for sort of 8 months. Similarly, caffeinated coffee is a bit of a no-no. So I've decaf, fully on the decaf rather than mostly on decaf since then, which my sister lives in France, and getting a decent decaf coffee in France is pretty tricky. So yeah, what you eat and drink. Yeah, on the sort of physical activity, what Jonathan Ramsay recommended was trying to limit running and cycling to 4 hours a week and no individual session being longer than an hour, which, yeah, considering I'd normally go for a 4 or 5 hour bike ride most weekends, is a bit of a challenge for me. Similarly, eating healthily, we haven't gone down the full sort of diet change, they're going to see a nutritionist and the sort of special recipe, special food. Like we cook from scratch most of the time. We eat pretty healthily, so I felt we were in the ballpark on that one. One that haven't been as good as I would like, they think a standing desk gets a little bit, keeps your testicles a little bit cooler. So that's one. Wearing cooler, lighter clothing. So I work from home a couple of days a week, so I don't tell my colleagues this, but sometimes sit working at a desk in pajama bottoms.
Oh, yeah. You're going to say sat in a desk in your boxers while in big meetings.
No. Or less.
I won't go into it now, but I do remember hearing a thing on the radio or seeing a thing on the internet about somebody that was in a meeting wearing not his boxers, stood up and then wondered why he got disciplined. But anyway, maybe he was just extreme trying to keep things cool to support his male fertility. Maybe he should have used that excuse rather than it was on a bank holiday and he didn't think that the normal rules apply about how he dressed.
Could you imagine rolling that excuse out? Well, I'm trying, you're just about to enter a cycle of fertility treatment, so I'm just keeping cool.
just play the big dog card and say that Professor Ramsay recommended it.
At the Male Fertility Podcast, we know how powerful the right support can be, which is why we've partnered with Fertility Family to share Imperil, that nutrition matters when it comes to fertility. But let's be honest, maintaining a perfectly balanced diet for conception is incredibly hard. Choosing a supplement can be just as confusing, especially when many multivitamins contain strong antioxidants that can actually harm sperm quality. Imperil is different. It's made from activated micronutrients that support every cell in the body, from the largest, the egg, to the smallest, the sperm. These nutrients have been clinically shown to significantly improve live birth rates in men and women who have previously been struggling to conceive. Imperil is different. It's made using activated micronutrients that support every cell in the body, from the largest, the egg, to the smallest, the sperm. These nutrients have been clinically shown to significantly improve live birth rates in men and women who have previously struggled to conceive. What we like is that behind the science at Fertility Family are real stories from real people. To find out more, visit www.fertilityfamily.co.uk. And if you decide it's right for you, our listeners get 10% off using the code MFPOD10. That's MFPOD10. Now, back to the episode.
But what you've mentioned there, mate, is all very, these are the common things and that are suggested. But it can be really daunting when you're first told it. They literally will say it like you experience, and then you leave that consultation room and it's, where do I start?
Where do I have fun?
Yeah.
There's caffeine, just, and like you said, the sport that you do that is not just a sport that you love, it's your social interaction and just all of that. And this is so, I know within anyone who's in the fertility, trying to conceive community understands, but this is such an underrepresented factor for people who just don't get it. And people who do essentially have all of those things and more and still manage to fucking get knocked up like easily. It's just rankly unfair, isn't it? It's all those bits and you have to overhaul your life and watch all the time. The exercise thing, clock watch. Oh, have I been exercising for, oh, it's 55 minutes, better cut it short.
Yeah.
It's not to be underestimated.
Yeah. And I think in terms of the exercise specifically, because I said that's one of the things that I found the hardest, it's the sort of mental health benefits of it as well. I think there's almost a double mental health. There's the mental health drain of the fact that, oh, I can't go for another bottle, I can't go for a bottle with my friends again. But there's also, I think, and I'm definitely don't know the details of this, but there's this all, Kieran, you're probably the man for this, but there's so much evidence about the kind of the general mental health benefits in terms of hormones and things from exercising, that if you're not able to, particularly if it's what you're used to, that can be really tough.
Yeah, we're designed, the modern world that we live in, indoors, sat at desks and things like that, we aren't designed for that. We want to be outside. Our bodies get a lot of natural enjoyment of just being outside nature, whatever you're doing, whether that's cycling for you or running or hiking or anything. Like the mental health benefits, people have written hundreds if not thousands of books on this. It's a real thing. And when that's taken away from you, like I was a cyclist, I loved downhill mountain biking, and it was the first thing that went, was diagnosed, and we were going through that treatment, and it's taken me ages to get back into that habit now. I'm going away in the summer for a week to do some downhill mountain bike. I haven't done that since we started all our treatment. It can have a real big impact on your life. And as you said, like, it's the social side of it as well. That's massive. Like, you lose your social group, which me and Sean have talked about endlessly, about how important a social group is, especially for men. The research is really out there in terms of men are happier, men live longer when they socialize and they can be with the boys. Whatever the boys look like, if you are cycling, whether that's in the gym, whether that's, it's such a important aspect of male makeup, like how we are designed. We are supposed to be in social groups. So yeah, it can be incredibly tough. You spoke earlier about how certain things in terms of exercise and sex, those were areas that really impacted in your life and you felt that effect, but you can't help it becoming everything you think about, because as you've just explained, Luke, like, you've listed pretty much most of my day Like, I get up in the morning, I have a coffee, and then I think about, I go to work, and then I might be sat at work for a bit, and then what am I wearing while I'm at work, and then what am I going to eat? And it just keeps rolling, doesn't it? And then you have to think about getting into bed and sleeping and things like that. And it's, you can't help but just become completely overtaken by it. The biggest part for me is knowing what I wanted to focus on one bit at a time, because it is so overwhelming. We started actually with our diet, and then we went to how I was training, because I felt like I was training all right. So actually, let's look at something where I knew I could improve a bit. I like food. I focus on that. Did you approach it like that, Luke? Or was it, let's try and do everything at once?
I think I'm generally a bit of a, this is what I've been told to do, let's do all of it. Like a bit, not quite all or nothing, but if you're going to do something, let's do it properly kind of thing. So
yeah,
I think I probably did try, and certainly after I'd seen Jonathan Ramsay, tried to be all in across the board. I think in the early days before I'd seen Jonathan, the thing that I didn't do as much of as perhaps could or should have done was stopping cycling. So the cycling club I'm a member of goes to usually Holland or Belgium every year and does a kind of long, what's called one of the spring classic cycling events, which is like some sort of ridiculous distance, like 250 kilometers in one day. So it's like eight, nine hours. And I'd already signed up. I'd already organized, I was involved with organizing the trip, because I'm quite a goal focused person. I was like, I'm doing this event in 3 months' time. I'll still keep doing some cycling so I can still get around that thing. So I think the other things I probably was better at, like I said, the sort of, we eat quite healthily. I don't drink much, so it was relatively easy for me to switch there. Decaf coffee, I was just a bit more committed to only drinking decaf if I was out and stuff. So yeah, I think probably I went quite quickly all in for everything except cycling.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the full cold turkey, I guess, after I'd seen Jonathan.
Did you find that taking those steps and controlling those areas helped you mentally cope with it better, in terms of, we're in this and these are the things that I'm doing to help contribute to this having a positive outcome? Did that help you, like, mentally, to know you're doing the right things?
It did help me. So my sort of first career, this is going back like 20 years, was in high performance sports coaching. And there's a whole sort of mantra in that sort of area, and like control the controllables. So like actually the fact that, and this I think was why it was helpful to see Jonathan Ramsay, is because like he'd said, blah, 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 these are the things that you need to do. Here's the evidence about why. So I think I was then in a position to actually, yeah, feel that I was empowered and knew what I was talking about and knew what I needed to do. And therefore, I think because I'm quite goal-focused, because the whole control the controllables mantra, yeah, I think it really did help me to start to, yeah, I guess feel a bit more back in control, as you say, Kieran. But also, yeah, the first half of last year was pretty tough for me mentally. And I think looking back on it now, it's been less bad since I've felt like I was, yeah, a bit more back in control.
Yeah, it does help. It does help.
I often get contacted by like female partners supporting their husbands or partners through the diagnosis. How important was your wife's support when you got your diagnosis? It's obvious that it is really important, but I think there is a whole listener group out there in terms of the partners and the wives that need to understand that, like, we do really want that support and that arm around us, and that's all be all right type of communication, even though at the moment it seems so tough. How was that support from your wife, and how important was it to you?
Yeah, so in terms of how important was it, like, so important, I think it's a pretty kind of tough, lonely place, and I think having somebody that you can talk to about that is definitely so important. And so, yeah, massive thanks to Helen for what she's done over the past, I guess, yeah, year and a bit. I think, to be honest, that's probably been more on the sort of mental health side, when, as I said, the first half of last year was like pretty tough. And yeah, she was, yeah, I guess both practically and emotionally there for me to keep things not quite on the road as such, to always be there for me and, yeah, and be that kind of supportive, kind of arm around the shoulder kind of thing, as you say.
I distinctly remember, I've talked about it before, like having real fear in talking to my wife about it. And not because I thought she'd reject it or she'd be upset about how I was feeling. I just hadn't opened up like that before. And her response, even though it was always going to be positive, it's very rarely negative in those situations, made things a lot easier. Made it a lot easier. And just that, it enabled me space to breathe and process. And it's something that I like to ask guests, because I think, like I said, there's a whole group of listeners out there that need to know the guys. We do want to talk about it. We do want that bit of comfort, but sometimes we just don't know how to approach it and maybe get it.
For sure. And especially since that both Helen and I aren't necessarily the sort of people that kind of wear our emotions on our sleeves normally. So I think it doesn't necessarily come naturally to me to share where I need a bit, share what's going on and share where I need a bit of support kind of thing. So I think it's definitely, it's probably definitely made us, I don't know, stronger as a couple in terms of the way we do communicate about stuff. And that's with some sort of counselling type support in terms of that sort of process. But I think we're definitely in a very different place now in terms of our ability to talk to each other about where we're at mentally, physically, emotionally, around the whole kind of process. There's the other ups and downs. I'm sure like every couple going through this kind of pretty traumatic kind of roller coaster journey. I'll use that journey word again, am I?
Good.
And you've said roller coaster, that's making it worse now.
I think it's made us stronger, it's made us better at listening to each other and being there for each other. And I guess on a sort of follow on note, I think the other thing, picking up, going right back to the beginning in terms of sort of initial question about what's brought me here now, is that I, since really talking to Jonathan Ramsey, have tried to be better at sharing what's going on in my life with other people. So like, I work in a quite small company, very supportive kind of work culture. And so I told everybody an away day, I think it was like last summer, like July or September or something last year. And everybody was fully on board. A couple of them have been on the IVF kind of bandwagon before. I think that kind of was a bit of an eye-opener in terms of they're not particularly close mates of mine. I've only worked there like a year and a bit at the time, but they were all really supportive. And similarly, like I've told sort of some of my close friends from university and my first sort of job after university, and same, they've all been like really supportive. Several of them have said they've IVF rounds in terms of most of them have got kids but have been involved with have had IVF. So I think in terms of the sort of telling other people, I've had no negative sort of impact of that. Everybody's been so supportive. And I think for me it's been really helpful, because you just get so stuck in your head. There's just, like we talked about before, there's just so much shit going on practically and emotionally, that sharing it with, first of all, with your partner and then with some kind of close friends. And I guess to complete that journey, like potentially sharing with the kind of the whole internet kind of thing. And I've thought a little bit about this. I'm not really, even coming towards the end of the recording, I've not necessarily come to an answer in terms of whether to post something on my social media just to say, by the way, in case I haven't talked to you about this. It feels a bit of a kind of big reveal and a slightly dramatic thing to say. But at the same time, there's never an easy way to have that conversation, even with friends. You can't quite engineer an angle to say, been going through an IVF process, like it's come up in terms of why I'm drinking decaf coffee or why I'm not drinking kind of thing. So like, I've found ways in to those kind of tricky conversations, but there's not an easy way in. There's not, it never comes up naturally. And actually a kind of big bang announcement of, this is my life story, go and hear for yourself why I've sometimes been a bit moody and sometimes not responded to your messages or whatever over the past year and a half, feels like it might be a kind of a getting something off my chest and feeling like it's a kind of secret anymore.
Yeah, it must be quite empowering. We don't talk about it, or historically haven't, and everyone's going through that silently. So when you do share, it just, it shows how much support can be out there if people are open.
Yeah, it feels like it's unburdened me, and that it has given me other sources of support. So it feels like it's a kind of a double win through sharing stuff rather than keeping it bottled up. I know that sounds a bit glib, but that's honestly where I feel I'm at.
It's one of those processes that you never want to go through, but I truly believe that you come out of it a better human, because you learn so much about yourself and about the world. It's a deeply personal thing, and part of what you've just expressed, Luke, is that transition from not really knowing what to do to actually feeling like you want to share it now, want to get it off your chest, but also it will have that knock-on effect. I'm sure that if you did, you'll get a message saying, oh, yeah, I've been through that. I think you'd be surprised, because I certainly was when I started sharing my journey.
Yeah, for sure. And I got, I guess it's, it feels like some of the male fertility conversations or sort of situation is in the same place as maybe where mental health stuff was about 10 or 15 years ago. Like, I've had some quite close family with some pretty tricky mental health stuff. It's all thankfully in a much better place now. But yeah, I can remember when I was in my 20s, it just wasn't a thing that you talked about. And it's now very different. And I guess my hope is that through me both sharing with my mates and also maybe through this sort of through this sort of opportunity is one step on the journey to normalizing it being something that people talk about.
It will. And also it will have massive benefits for your friendships as well. When one person shows vulnerability and openness, it typically does then promote that within the relationship. So that's certainly what I've noticed in our friendship group. So I take credit for that. And so should you on your end, because yeah, it's a big thing to do. And yeah, like you said, where the mental health conversation is now, we can only hope that the fertility one is moving that way as well.
Yeah, no, for sure. Keep chipping away one step at a time. As we talked about in terms of the sort of treatment process, it's probably just the same thing here, right? It's marginal gains.
Yeah, we're slowly chipping away. And you're right, we're about 15 years away from where we need to be. But the more people that talk, the quicker we get there, maybe. Yeah. Look, man, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. We've covered so much. It's been unbelievable. But we always finish with one question. All right. And that question is, if you could give your younger self a bit of advice regarding fertility, what would it be?
Yeah, the killer question that no matter how many times I hear it answered on the podcast, that I still don't have a good answer myself. I think probably the best I can do is something about just don't assume that, I guess you go through your teens and 20s, like being really careful about wearing a condom or everything else. And then you suddenly want to switch it around. And there's just an assumption that shit will just happen. And so I think, yeah, just don't assume, I guess, just be aware that that might not be the case. And then I guess probably that what follows on from that, I don't know if I'm allowed two things that I might tell for myself, is just, yeah, understand what the options are, what the kind of, what things you might want to be aware of, all the lifestyle changes we talked about, that there is support out there, that there are things that can be done to make, to get over this, the sort of male factor stuff. So yeah, don't assume, and it's not a done deal. Once you get the diagnosis, would probably be my one and a half things.
Yeah, really good advice. Thank you. And that's what it's all about. It's, I think it's, like I said earlier, this one person's stories could be another person's survival guide. And there's so much great information and advice throughout the episode. So thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Pleasure. Hopefully, as you say, it'll be of some use to someone somewhere.
Oh, no, I have absolutely no doubt.
It's been amazing, mate. It was an absolute pleasure. And keep in touch, and we'll speak to you soon, mate.
Thanks, both.